You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Forward Motion by David Camp, with photographs by Simon Upton. For decades, Longleat has been a byword in the British press for eccentricity, primarily because Lord Bath, the current Marquess, Sulan's father, is known for an unusual living arrangement in which he remains married to Sulan's mother, Lady Bath, but keeps an array of mistresses he refers to as wifelets, some of whom he has put up in cottages on the property. Lady Bath spends a good part of her time in France. The wifelets have numbered more than 70. I did not get to meet Lord Bath, but he is a memorable presence in a BBC One documentary series that aired in 2015, entitled All Change at Longleat, which chronicled Sulan and Emma's attempts to modernize the estate while gingerly managing a generational shift in power. Lord Bath ceded control of Longleat's operations to Sulan in 2010 and still lives in his own apartment on an upper floor. In the docuseries, he appears as a plump, messy, libertine character with flowing white hair and a white beard, Gandalf crossed with Galifianakis. The handover, alas, has not proceeded harmoniously. In keeping with the younger generation's family-friendly mandate, Sulan removed some of the lurid, heavily impastoed murals that his father had himself painted on the private apartment's walls, variously depicting nude figures and Boshin frightscapes. Lord Bath took such umbrage at this action that he boycotted Emma and Sulan's wedding. Emma, by contrast, enjoyed a more conventional upbringing, even if it was unorthodox at its inception. Her mother, a London social dynamo named Susanna McQuiston, was a divorced mother of two grown children when she had an affair with Oladipo Jadesimi, a married Nigerian-born chartered accountant. Emma was the result. Jadesimi returned to Nigeria and went on to prosper as the founder and chairman of the Lagos Deep Offshore Logistics Base, LODOL, which supplies support services to offshore gas and oil exploration companies. Today, he is among the wealthiest men in West Africa. Emma was raised in South Kensington, one of London's poshest enclaves, by her mother and her half-sister Samantha, who is 21 years her senior. She attended the Queen's Gate School, a day school for girls. Its alumnae include Tilda Swinton and Camilla, Duchess of Cornwall, and thrived socially and academically. She went on to take a degree in art history from University College, London, where she became close friends with Ed Tang, the son of the late Hong Kong-based businessman, fashion mogul, and restaurateur Sir David Tang. The younger Tang, who is now an art advisor in New York and the godfather to John, recalls Emma as a self-confident, almost compulsively hospitable force of nature. Food was a big part of us growing up together, he told me. Emma liked to bring me back to her family's house and feed me, things like Sunday roast and desserts from scratch, but also Chinese food, a daring thing to attempt around someone with my background, and she passed with flying colors. She was always someone who liked to roll up her sleeves and always comfortable within herself. Next photos, the Viscountess with Thorn, one of the giraffes in Longleat's Safari Park, and the Viscountess in the family apartment at Longleat House with labradoodles, monkey, and mouse. Among the settings in which Emma found herself at ease as a girl was Longleat. When she was three, her half-brother, Ian McQuiston, the eldest of her mother's children, married Lady Sylvie Thynne, the current Marquess' half-sister. Lord Bath, ever the iconoclast, dropped the E from his surname in the 1970s. As a result of this marriage, Sulin and Emma became known quantities to each other at family gatherings. Though barely, he is 12 years her senior. "So I would be running around," Emma said, "and he would be sitting down having a coffee." I mentioned to Emma that I had read an interview with her mother in which she said something that, from my American perspective, I found difficult to believe, that Emma had never experienced racism growing up. "It's true. It's really true," Emma said. "I was just really lucky. I mean, London's such a cosmopolitan place." Her mother and sister, she said, did such a solid job between them of making me feel very settled. "My dad's Nigerian, and I grew up in London, and that's just how it is." It wasn't until 2011 when Emma and Sulin, by then 25 and 37, ran into each other at Soho House, the private club in London, that a romance sparked. When they became engaged the following year, they did not anticipate their marriage being any kind of watershed. From my perspective, and with hindsight, I can see that it was incredibly naive. I absolutely believed that in the UK we lived in a post-racial society, said Sulin. So I asked Sulin, had he no trepidation about going public, no anticipation of racist blowback in aristocratic circles? "Not for a moment, not for a moment," he said. "Not saying there weren't ripples. You're probably aware of one in particular." Both of Emma's parents attended her wedding at Longleat. Jedesimi, who goes by the nickname Lottie, gave away his daughter while wearing a striped agbada, or wide-sleeved robe, that he'd had made in Nigeria, especially for the occasion. However, Sulin's immediate family was represented only by his sister, Lady Linka Thynne. Lord and Lady Bath opted to attend the wedding of another couple, a pair of polo players who were getting married the same day. Lord Bath was still irritated with his son about the murals. Lady Bath was another story. Born Anna Germarthy in Hungary and raised in Paris, she married Alexander, the future Marquess, in 1969. When she was a model and actress appearing in erotic films under the name Anna Gale, Sulin won't rehash the matter now, but in September 2015, he told the Sunday Times that he had prohibited his mother from attending the wedding because, in a conversation that they had regarding his engagement to Emma, she said in three different instances that her son's actions would affect 400 years of bloodline. That's when he put his foot down. Emma is the least confrontational, least dramatic person, but I don't think anyone could have that happen at least three times and not just say, "Well, F this," he told the Times. In the following week's Sunday Times, Lady Bath gave a rare interview in which she denied that she is racist and said that she would never use the word bloodline because I don't even know that word. I am not English. In the BBC documentary series, which aired right around the time that Sulin's comments about his mother went public, a bit of a thaw seems to occur between father and son. With Sulin and Emma paying a visit to Lord Bath's apartment with John, then a baby, Lord Bath briefly cradles his grandson in his arms. In another noteworthy scene, Lord Bath is seen spending time with one of his longest-serving and most age-appropriate wifelets, Silvana Enriquez, who was a Bond girl in 1969's on Her Majesty's Secret Service, and who happens to be black. Together, they listen to a song he wrote for her that appeared on a 1974 LP he recorded under the name Alexander Lord Weymouth, "I Play the Host." It was released on Pi Records, the Kinks' original label. An acoustic folk ballad, the song includes the lyrics, "Hello there, you mulberry-colored Venus, We shouldn't let my whiteness come between us. But Sulin told me that, for all the TV show's intimations of rapprochement and mutual understanding, he and Emma are currently in communication with neither his father nor his mother. I ask him if he might make a new push for reconciliation, given that there are now two grandchildren involved. A pained expression came over his face. "I'd just rather not dwell on it for the purposes of this article," he said. For all the dysfunction within the Thin family and interviews, Lord Bath has spoken of a difficult relationship with his own father, the 6th Marquess, a slim, elegant, rather more traditionally cheerio-chaps-looking aristo who died in 1992. Sulin acknowledges a maverick streak common to the last three generations of Thin men, a thread of not being constrained by other people's judgments, as he puts it. His grandfather Henry, for whom his second son is named, was the first British peer ever to open up his home to paying visitors in 1949. "It was unheard of," Sulin told me. "I think people within his milieu were quite scandalized." But Henry's instincts proved sharp. By 1966, recognizing that Longleat would require significantly greater income still to survive, he opened the world's first safari park outside of Africa. Today, it receives about 1 million visitors a year. Sulin and Emma are pursuing an even more audacious path, with plans afoot to break ground in 2019 on a 350-acre American replica of Longleat at a site they have scouted in the eastern United States. There will be a safari park, but their development team's research indicates that the U.S. customer base, currently in the throes of an Anglophilia fueled by Downton Abbey, The Crown, and yes, Harry and Meghan, is even more responsive to the concept of walking through a faithfully recreated British manor house. Emma's afternoon teas have proved a particularly appealing component for the Englishness I bring, she said, the quintessential hominess thing that we do here. Earlier generations of nobility would have held their noses at such explicit commercial exploitation of their brands and would have asphyxiated themselves in the process. A few years ago, Julian Fellowes, the creator of Downton Abbey, told me that an air of melancholy hangs over the program, set in the teens and twenties. Because its aristocratic protagonist, the Crawleys, are planning for the next 100 years, and they'll be lucky if they get 20. Next photo, the 128-room Longleat, completed in 1580, on grounds designed by Capability Brown. As it happens, Fellowes is friendly with the younger Thins and is supportive of their vision. "I think that their modern and imaginative approach to the task in hand is the best thing that could happen to Longleat," he wrote in an email. Unlike many of their kind, both of them understand the century they are living in, and one of the central paradoxes of owning a historic house is that the more up-to-date you're thinking, the more likely you are to preserve your inheritance and its traditions. Here's another paradox. Part of the Thins' up-to-date appeal lies in their biracial identity. It was a mind-bending exercise to process Black Twitter's exuberant response to the news of Harry and Meghan's engagement last November. On one hand, the triumphal sense of identification, Prince Harry's future mother-in-law is a Black woman with dreadlocks. "There are no words for this kind of joy," read one popular tweet, is perfectly understandable. On the other hand, we're talking about an institution, the British monarchy, that for most of its existence has been synonymous with empire and colonization. I reached out to the Anglo-Nigerian writer Bim Adewunmi of BuzzFeed, who has written with tenderness and bemusement about her own mother's love of Princess Diana, to see what, if anything, she made of Emma. Her response was fundamentally pro, if tied up in knots of ambivalence. So many times the onus is placed on the racial minority in a space to modernize or otherwise fix broken and antiquated structures, she said. Emma is one woman swimming against a vast tide of tradition. And anyway, is she even swimming against it? Maybe she's just trying to live her best life. But you know, we see a would-be Black Martianess, and it means something, even when it doesn't. Emma herself never felt the need to reckon with her meaning until she became a public figure. She's a breezy, effortless conversationalist when talking about food, kids, and Longleat. Such as when she points out a Titian or notes the improbably sassy pink sash worn by one of Sulin's male forebears in a portrait, but is more deliberate in assessing her own place in this grand picture. When you ask me about the significance of it, the feeling of it, of course it's for the children, she said. Whatever I've done, if it's to represent something, to move something forward, if that's how it's being put, I'm thrilled. But it's really about our children's generation. They're 3 and 1. Can you imagine when they're in their 30s, what things will be like? At this, Sulin looked fondly at his wife, his one and only wife. Henry, the baby, started crying. I dropped half a meringue on the floor. The Viscountess picked it up before I could, deflecting my apology. What things will be like? Perhaps, for the first time in ages at Longleat, normal.
Thank you.
an American princess. With her Hollywood upbringing, humanitarian impulse, and strong sense of self, Meghan Markle already shines in the spotlight. In an excerpt from her new book, author Leslie Carroll tells the story of Meghan's early life. Excerpted from the book, American Princess, The Love Story of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry, by Leslie Carroll. Copyright 2018 by Leslie Carroll. Reprinted by permission of William Morrow Paperbacks, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. Opening photo, Meghan Markle in her bedroom in Los Angeles, circa 1987. On July 29, 1981, Doria Lois Ragland was days away from giving birth to her first child with Thomas Markle. Around the world, 750 million people were glued to their television sets to watch the royal wedding of the Prince of Wales and Lady Diana Spencer. How could Doria and Thomas ever have imagined that the second son born to the royal couple would someday get down on one knee and propose to their daughter, not yet even born? Americans are more likely to win the lottery. Doria and Thomas's marriage was one made in Hollywood. As reported in the Daily Mail in the late 1970s, Thomas, a divorced father of two, was a lighting director for the popular ABC soap opera General Hospital when he fell for Doria Ragland, who was temping as an assistant makeup artist. Thomas, then 35, and Doria, 23, married on December 23, 1979. At the Self-Realization Fellowship Temple, a new agey church on Sunset Boulevard, the 6'3" groom, wearing a tweed blazer and ginger-hued shirt, towered over his 5'2" bride. Doria looked like a schoolgirl in a modest white pleated skirt and short-sleeved blouse with a coronet of baby's breath in her hair. Their only child, Rachel Meghan Markle, was born less than 2 years later, on August 4, 1981. From the start, Meghan was adored by her parents. Doria's nickname for her has always been Flower. According to his son from his first marriage, Thomas Jr., who was living with his father and stepmother when he was 14, Thomas Markle had been a workaholic until Meghan was born. The family lived in a neighborhood that Meghan has described as leafy and affordable. On paper, a great place to raise their daughter. What the area wasn't was diverse. In an article for Elle magazine in 2015, Meghan wrote, "There was my mom, caramel in complexion, with her light-skinned baby in tow, being asked where my mother was, since they assumed she was my nanny." Meghan acknowledged that she was too young at the time to comprehend how difficult it must have been for her parents to endure such institutional prejudice, but they made a safe and happy place for her in the world. When Meghan was about 7 years old, she coveted a particular boxed set of Barbie dolls for Christmas. The Hart family consisted of a mommy, a daddy, and two kids. A perfect nuclear family, as imagined by Mattel. But the sets were sold only in white families or black families. In her Elle article, Meghan recalled not particularly caring at the time which set she received, just that she wanted one of them. In her immediate family, skin color had never been politicized. That Christmas morning, under the tree was a box wrapped in holiday paper flecked with glitter. Meghan opened her gift to discover a black mommy, a white daddy, and a child of each skin color. Her father had customized the hearts. Whenever anyone marries into the British royal family, genealogists have a field day. Meghan and Harry have proved no exception. Catherine Middleton and Prince William were discovered to be 14th cousins once removed through his mother and 15th cousins through his father. Their common ancestors go all the way back to the Plantagenets and the reign of Edward III, who ruled from 1327 to 1377. According to genealogist Gary Boyd Roberts, a researcher at the New England Historic Genealogical Society in Boston, Meghan and Harry are 17th cousins, thanks again to the prolific Edward III, who had 9 children who survived to adulthood. According to Roberts, one of Edward's myriad descendants was an ancestor of Meghan's father, the Reverend William Skipper, who arrived in New England in 1639. Other common ancestors can be traced back to the 15th century, such as Sir Philip Wentworth, a knight and courtier, who was a great-grandfather to Jane Seymour, third wife of Henry VIII. Mary Clifford, daughter of John Clifford, the 7th Baron de Clifford, and Elizabeth Bowes and her husband Richard Bowes, ancestors of Queen Elizabeth. Meghan may have other family ties to Windsor Castle, as reported in the Daily Mail. Family lore via the husband of a second cousin of Meghan's father, former U.S. Air Force Colonel Ken Barbie, holds that Markle's great-great-great-grandmother, Mary Bird, worked at the palaces. A search of royal household staff records does locate an M. Bird, who was employed at Windsor Castle in 1856. Furthermore, Markle will be the first person who is a descendant of slaves to marry into the British royal family, something that the tabloid press has seized on and trumpeted to tone-deaf and often worse effect. At the same time that Mary Bird would have been working for Queen Victoria, and while some Markle ancestors were living in prosperity in New England, still other forebears were forced to live as someone's property in rural Georgia. A rundown railway town almost due south of Atlanta, Jonesboro has a few claims to fame. The site of a Civil War battle, it was also where the author of Gone with the Wind, Margaret Mitchell, spent a good deal of her childhood. Meghan's ancestor, Richard Ragland, who was born into slavery near Jonesboro around 1830, as reported in the Sunday Times. That part of Georgia, Clayton County, was on the edge of the western frontier. Revolutionary War veterans were encouraged to become pioneers by entering land lotteries. But it was rough, inhospitable territory that the government had seized from Native Americans. Nothing of the moonlight and magnolias of Mitchell's revisionist fantasy. One of the people who settled this land was an American of English descent. William Ragland was a Methodist whose family originally came from Cornwall. A planter and land speculator, he had moved from Virginia to North Carolina to Georgia. Slaves were often given their masters' surnames, as was the case with Richard. After his emancipation, Richard and his descendants became one of Georgia's black families named Ragland. Meghan's great-great-grandparents, Jeremiah Ragland and Claudie Ritchie, left Jonesboro for Chattanooga, Tennessee, but the family fled the region's prejudice and violence during the Jim Crow era, moving north, then west, as part of the Great Migration. With so many white men being sent overseas to fight, the recruitment of African Americans by northern industries resulted in employment opportunities. In California, the Raglands became teachers and real estate agents. Meghan's maternal grandfather, Alvin, married a nurse who gave birth in 1956 to Doria. Meghan describes her mother as a free spirit, and others say she is as effervescent as her daughter. Giggly, warm, passionate, brilliant, nurturing, and fun, according to a friend who has known her since Meghan was a baby. Doria was born and raised in a middle-class African-American community of Los Angeles. She later earned a master's degree in social work from the University of Southern California and became a yoga instructor. Her specialty is working with geriatric clients. Doria still lives in Los Angeles and View Park, Windsor Hills, one of the wealthiest primarily African-American residential neighborhoods in the United States. Thomas Markle, meanwhile, had grown up in a small blue-collar town in Pennsylvania. He wanted to be a stage technician, so he moved to Chicago, where he worked on local theater and television productions. Thomas was only 20 when he met Rosalind Lovelace. She was already pregnant with Samantha, the first of their two children, when they married. Samantha's brother, Thomas Jr., was born 2 years later, but within 8 years their marriage was over. Rosalind moved to New Mexico with their children, while Thomas headed for that iconic Hollywood sign. And that was how things went until 1979, when Doria stepped into his life. But the marriage was not made to last. Megan's parents separated in 1983 when she was only 2 years old, but they made every attempt to provide their young daughter with a stable home environment. Next photos, an 8-year-old Markle playing the Queen, complete with a British accent, in a game she called Your Royal Highness. After the separation, the three of them would still vacation together, as Sam Cashner reported in Vanity Fair. On Sunday evenings, after Meghan had spent the weekend with her father, the burly, bearded Thomas would drop her back at her mother's, a second-story home on a wide street lined with stately royal palms in the diverse Miracle Mile neighborhood. The single-family homes and low-rise multi-unit dwellings feature classic Southern California architecture, stucco facades with terracotta roofs. Out front, postage stamp-size lawns are fringed with flowers and succulents. In Doria's apartment, after Thomas brought Megan home, the trio would watch Jeopardy together as they ate their dinner off TV trays in front of the set. Never once did little Megan catch her parents arguing. She would often see her half-siblings when she visited her dad, and got along well with both of them. In 1987, the year her parents finally divorced, a new sitcom, Married with Children, hit the air. Thomas was a lighting director for 11 episodes during the first season, and from 1988 through 1996, logged 198 episodes as the show's director of photography. Megan was a frequent visitor to the set, where the stars would make a fuss over her. She was bitten by the acting bug before she became old enough to be inoculated against the hardships of a career in show business. Back then, Megan wore her hair in a fluffy ponytail or in two braids secured at the top and bottom of each plait. Megan's grammar school class picture hung on the white wall of her bedroom. Stars, hearts, and rainbows abounded on the matching Care Bears curtains and comforter that covered her bed. Also hanging on her wall was the iconic World War II We Can Do It poster of Rosie the Riveter, hair neatly tucked under a polka-dot red kerchief and shirt sleeves rolled up, arm flexed to prove she's as capable as any man. Social awareness came early. Megan was raised to give back. As she wrote on her now-defunct lifestyle site, The Tig, at Thanksgiving, the family bought turkeys for homeless shelters and delivered meals to patients living in hospice care. Megan noticed the quiet acts of grace her parents would perform for those who had less, whether it was donating their spare change or acknowledging their shared humanity in a small way. A hug, a smile, or a pat on the back. It was a life lesson that stuck forever. Megan had been only 9 years old when the violent police beating of Rodney King made news. A year later, when the four Los Angeles police officers who had so viciously beaten King were acquitted, unrest and arson spread throughout the Los Angeles metropolitan area. To ensure the children's safety, Megan's school sent the students home. Ash from the street fires was everywhere, settling on suburban lawns. As Megan later recounted to Vanity Fair, she exclaimed, "Oh my God, Mommy, it's snowing." "No, Flower, it's not snow," her mother told her. "Get in the house." Megan's activism started not long after, as she was watching television commercials for a social studies assignment about messaging. First up, a spot for Robitussin cough syrup that referenced Dr. Mom. Young Megan was immediately struck. "It's always Mom does this, and Mom does that." Then the ad for Ivory dishwashing liquid came on the air. Women are fighting greasy pots and pans. Megan knew the premise was sexist, and she decided to do something about it when two of the boys in her class started yelling at the TV screen that the kitchen is where women belong. Megan recounted her memories about that formative assignment at the United Nations on International Women's Day in 2015. "I remember feeling shocked and angry and also just feeling so hurt. It just wasn't right, and something needed to be done. So I went home and told my dad what had happened, and he encouraged me to write letters. So I did, to the most powerful people I could think of." Megan's letter to the soaps manufacturer, Procter & Gamble, read, "So I was wondering if you would be able to change the commercial to people." She also sent letters to civil rights lawyer Gloria Allred, then First Lady Hillary Clinton, and Linda Ellerbe, a Nickelodeon news anchor. Ellerbe was so impressed that she did a segment on Megan. A month or so later, Megan saw the commercial again. The voiceover now said, "People are fighting greasy pots and pans." Megan told her UN audience, "It was at that moment that I realized the magnitude of my actions. At the age of 11, I had created my small level of impact by standing up for equality." With success comes responsibility. That's one of the tenets of Megan's Los Angeles high school alma mater, Immaculate Heart. She didn't need to be taught it. It was and remains part of her ethos. With time and her own rising star, Megan would also come to see how her profile could create a platform, and she has used it to become involved in global and women's issues that are not only of personal interest to her, but of vital urgency to the planet. She traveled to India in January 2017 to learn about women's economic development. When she learned that 113 million adolescent girls are at risk of dropping out of school in India because they lack the social support and sanitary supplies to deal with their monthly periods, she campaigned to raise awareness. Megan also has been an ambassador for the World Vision's Clean Water Campaign, journeying to Rwandan villages to highlight the importance of building clean wells. In her speech at the United Nations, she advocated for gender inclusion. "Women need a seat at the table. They need an invitation to be seated there. And in some cases, when this is not available, they need to create their own table. We need a global understanding that we cannot implement change effectively without women's political participation." Now, according to Kensington Palace, Megan will begin her married life with a fresh slate, which means a focus on different charities, likely those already under the umbrella of the foundation that Prince Harry shares with his brother and the Duchess of Cambridge. Perhaps her causes are viewed by the Crown as too political. No member of the royal family is permitted to publicly express a political opinion. It remains to be seen whether Meghan can convince the Windsors that her activism should be enfolded into Harry's foundation as well. British historian David Starkey noted that Meghan and Harry's union is the first globalized royal marriage. She is international in a way which no other royal has ever been. Yes, Meghan Markle is different from every royal bride in the long history of the British monarchy, in all the ways the public and press have focused on. But Meghan Markle is something else that no other royal has ever been. She is a standard bearer for young women who have been told that it's impossible to have it all. Meghan embodies a spirit of can-do. When it comes to her racial identity, or her career, or her philanthropy, her status as an independent woman, or the wife of a prince, Meghan has never been either or, but always fiercely, proudly, both. Meghan's world. As the soon-to-be royal inhabits her new life as a Windsor, she'll have to navigate an increasingly complex orbit of real friends, fake friends, climbers, and clingers-on, by Josh Duboff. Opening illustration by MVM, which is a stylized drawing of Meghan Markle. For as much as one gains in material terms by marrying into the royal family, jewels, palace, apartments, Hamilton tickets, there is just as much to lose. If you were not a member of British royal-adjacent high society from birth, you would suddenly find yourself in an unfamiliar world, with a complete lack of privacy and anonymity, a calendar of public events, and a crush of critics. Meghan Markle reportedly met Prince Harry when she was 34 years old. She had been married before and was starring on a successful basic cable television series, Suits. She had a lifestyle website and more than 1 million Instagram followers. She also had a close-knit circle of friends, many of whom appeared in that social media feed, dining, laughing, and traveling around the world. Now that she is marrying the man who is fifth, soon to be sixth, in line to the British throne, though, Markle is leaving that role behind. She'll become a citizen of the UK. She has shut down her site, The Tig, as well as her social media accounts. But the question remains whether she will have to give up her friends and confidants as well. Traditionally, those who marry into the royal family find themselves completely subsumed by their new station. As Toronto-based Royal Observer Patricia Treville points out, now that Markle is in the firm, as the royal family is known, her associations are going to be monitored much more closely and strategically. The royals are very careful about being seen with people who are perhaps out for something of their own. And in a photo chart, circle of friends, the relationships that make up Meghan's orbit, and Meghan is pictured at the very center. Socialites, Misha Nanu, fashion designer, Marcus Anderson, consultant for Soho House, Ben Mulroney, a television host, and his wife, Jessica, a stylist and consultant, Violet von Westenholtz, British socialite, BFFs, Heather Dorak, Pilates instructor, Benita Litt, brand curator, Lindsay Jill Roth, television producer, family, Thomas Jr., Meghan's half-brother, Guy, one of Meghan's two dogs, who moved with her to London, Samantha Markle, Meghan's half-sister, Thomas Markle, Meghan's father, Doria Ragland, Meghan's mother, in-laws, Prince Charles, Prince Harry's father and his wife, Camilla, Duchess of Cornwall, Prince George and Princess Charlotte, children of the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, Queen Elizabeth II, Kate and Prince William, the Duchess and Duke of Cambridge, stars, Serena Williams, tennis champion, Priyanka Chopra, actress and film producer, Janina Gavankar, actress, Abigail Spencer, actress, all revolving around Meghan Markle. So, are these people friends or are they advisors? There's a difference. You have a lot of people who will say, I know them, but I'm not their friend. I work with them, but I'm not their friend. You look at all the senior royals, and they're incredibly careful about whom they're friends with. They end up having lots of acquaintances or people who know them. Markle already defies precedent. She is unusual as a royal bride because she had such an extensive public profile before meeting Prince Harry, says London-based royal watcher Emily Nash of Hello magazine. I think it was inevitable that once their relationship became serious, she would shut down her social media accounts. But deactivating Instagram doesn't necessarily mean she is no longer keeping up with her friends. Nash says that while Markle will be getting used to a more discreet social life, she is still going to be seeing and speaking to her most trusted friends just as before. The exact shape those friendships will take is what remains to be seen. Markle, who was born and raised in Los Angeles and went to college at Northwestern just outside Chicago, began filming Suits in Toronto in 2011. Though she wasn't a celebrity while she lived and worked in the Canadian city, one Toronto gossip reporter told me she was very much off their radar pre-Harry. She did run with a chic, affluent crowd. Markle, who wrote of her homebody tendencies on her lifestyle website, now reportedly maintains a low-key day-to-day existence with Harry. But Toronto-based gossip writer and TV host Elaine Laney Louis says that while Markle wasn't a constant presence on the scene, she was in with what would be considered by Toronto standards the social influencers. Louis adds, "I wouldn't say she was the type to be out every single night, but I would say that she was pretty selective about the events she did attend, and that crowd was Toronto society." During her time in Toronto, Markle developed a friendship with Marcus Anderson, a consultant at Soho House, the members-only club with locations in London, Toronto, New York, and elsewhere. Anderson and Markle often attended events together, and she even referred to Anderson as the uncle of her two dogs, Guy and Bogart. Guy has since relocated to London, while Bogart reportedly remains with friends in Toronto. According to Toronto reporter Shinan Giovanni, Markle met other friends through ex-boyfriend Corey Vitiello, a well-known Toronto chef whom she reportedly dated for about 2 years prior to her relationship with Prince Harry. A lot of the contacts she ended up making were because of Vitiello, says Giovanni, who once entertained the couple at a dinner party at his house. He was this strapping young guy who cooked, and he had this thing where he bridged uptown and downtown Toronto. Markle's inner circle also included the telegenic Toronto power couple Ben and Jessica Mulroney. Ben is a television presenter and the son of former Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, while Jessica is a stylist and consultant. The Mulroneys have double-dated with current Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his wife Sophie, whom Jessica has often styled. Markle and Jessica Mulroney became fast friends, connecting over a shared affection for yoga and frequently taking vacations together. Mulroney posted an Instagram about 2 years ago of her and Markle on a trip to Italy, with the caption, "Happy wife, happy life," including the hashtag, #fakehoneymoon. The Jessica Mulroney relationship was key in that it opened up the ecosystem of her world, Giovanni says. It's what probably connected her to people like Justin Trudeau and to Sophie, and I think also to Marcus and Soho House. In addition to Jessica Mulroney, Markle's socialite squad included New York-based designer Misha Nanu. Nanu and Markle have traveled together to Europe with Anderson along for the revelry and the Instagrams. This is the life of casual travel and nights out that Markle will have to leave behind, even if she manages to maintain the friendships. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.